Hello and welcome to the Pod of the Damned. I'm your host, Ian. Joining me this week is my co-host, Candy. How's it going, Candy?
Pretty good. How about you?
I realised I was really enthusiastic there when I did that opening hello. I was just like, oh, I caught myself off guard a little bit. I was like, oh, maybe it was a bit too much. I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for joining me. Here we are. There's no Nico today, unfortunately. Nico is having to deal with some family issues. He's fine. He sends his best wishes. He sends his regards. And he's also said that he'll give us a brief overview of his thoughts on today's movie when he rejoins us next week on the show. So I'm
awesome,
sure.
Because I'm very curious.
I'm sure he's going to have some thoughts. Big thank you to everyone who's been downloading and listening to our last few episodes, obviously. Just to remind everyone, obviously, Candy, you're relatively new to the Pod of the Damned family. So thank you to everyone who's been sending out your love and support during the first few episodes that you have been on. We've gotten a really good reception of them. You know, people have been giving us some really nice comments on social media as well. I know you've seen some of them as well, Candy. So thank you very much to everyone who's been doing that. We really appreciate all of you guys who download and listen to us every single week, who leave us reviews, who interact with us, because without you guys, you know, this podcast is nothing. We do this for our listeners, so thank you very much, and I'm sure I speak on Candy's behalf as well when I say that too. Also, I'm not sure if you do it in a different date in America, Candy, but it's Mother's Day here in the UK, so happy Mother's Day.
Thank you. Yeah, it's in May for us, usually like right before my daughter's birthday. I remember being pregnant and thinking, does this count? Because I haven't had my baby yet, so.
Oh, it counts. It counts. another big thing that's happening for us this week, I think you do celebrate this Sunday. It's St. Patrick's Day this Sunday. And I know it's places outside of Ireland that celebrate St. Patrick's Day more than Ireland itself. I think it's a pretty big thing over there. I know for you guys in the States, in certain places, it used to be a really big thing here in Scotland. But that was more just an excuse for us to all go out and get drunk
and
drink a lot, which it's still used as an excuse for many, many people. I'll be working it this year, so I'll have to deal with a lot of drunk people.
Yeah, my lineage is mainly Irish.
So is that a big one for you? Do you celebrate it at all? Do you like mark it?
I'm not a drinker too much, mm-hmm. so I don't celebrate the way people do here by getting really drunk. and the green beer is really – I don't like beer at all.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of one of those things like, I'm Irish or whatever. you're supposed to wear green or people will pinch you or something. I don't think they do that as much anymore.
Yeah.
And people wearing the Kiss Me, I'm Irish kind of shirts, and it's really tacky.
Yeah, I think it's like, because obviously for us, we've got St. Andrew's Day, which is our patron saint, but I think even Scottish people celebrate St. Patrick's Day more than we celebrate our own one, so, but yeah, I think for a lot of things, that sort of, like, old-style behaviour that we're talking about is just something else that sort of COVID killed off, wasn't it, you know?
Mm-hmm. COVID changed a lot. I mean, and it's not something like the things that you would think about. They're kind of small things, but they add up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. Like when you,
like Walmart used to be open 24 hours. Like if I needed to go get something in the middle of the night, I could go there. Mm-hmm. But nothing's open 24 hours anymore.
No, a lot of our big, we still have like sort of corner shops that are open 24 hours. But a lot of our like big supermarkets and things that used to be open 24 hours, at least in this part of the country, are the same. They've stopped doing that as well. So
yeah, like gas stations or like stuff like that will be open for 24 hours. But like anything else, it's a bummer because sometimes I just, you know, I'm an insomniac, so I'd want to go, you know, to Target or to Walmart in the middle of the night and just fuck around and, you know,
I always used to buy a bathroom rug
or something.
Honestly, if I was going to go do like food shopping or anything, I always used to prefer going in the middle of the night because, you know, there's
early in the morning.
There's a lot less people there. And I don't know if you feel the same, but going to the supermarket at like busy peak time in the day is just
stressful to me.
Yeah.
Because some people have like road rage. I have like walking range. So people who like park their carts in the middle of the aisle or they're standing there talking to somebody, I'm like, listen, I need to get to the fucking macaroni and cheese. Can you move it along?
I absolutely not. I feel that so hard.
Fucking my way.
Anyways, we are a horror podcast that deep dives into a different topic every single week in our quest to create a leaderboard of the best and worst horror movies of all time. This is episode number 106, and in today's show, it's Candy's choice. It's your first official choice. And I don't think anyone who's listened to either of our shows will be surprised that your very first choice is Tenenbaum.
Yep. I felt like it'd be false advertising if I didn't just go straight for the Italian horror.
It was, yes, I very, very much saw this coming. I very, very much saw your next choice coming as well, but we'll go over that when we get to that one too. But before we get into it, if anyone who's listening to this wants to support this podcast outside of just listening to us, you can follow us on our social media platforms. We're on X at Damned Podcast. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram, Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com. And you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podofthedamned. So you've picked Tenenbaum, and obviously, I finally, after telling you that I was going to send it to you for quite a while, I finally sent you the leaderboard. At the end of the show, we'll get an update on a few of the movies that you've sort of ranked, because you've said you've gone through them and you've rated them all. So we're going to go through a few of them at the end and start updating that leaderboard with your ones. But now that you know and you can see where everything sorts of sits, you're taking Nico's place today. Where do you think, where would you sort of judge between the critics and our listeners and ourselves, where do you think Tenenbaum is going to land on our leaderboard?
It's a hard one because it's not a movie that everyone's seen unless you really start getting more into foreign horror, Italian horror, because it's kind of famously dubbed badly. You know, I don't know. So I'm going to say maybe somewhere in the middle for the Argento fans out there. So I'm going to say maybe 40.
Right. Yep. So we've this is the 98th movie that we'll have covered on the show. So yeah, in the sort of 40 to 50 range is slap bang in the middle. That would put it currently there alongside movies like Don't Breathe, An American Werewolf in London, the original Child's Play, Arachnophobia. Those are the sorts of movies that are in and around there, which are all pretty decent movies. I'd probably say the three of them are really, really good, and then you've got Don't Breathe, but still.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think that's terrible company for, you know, any horror movie out there. You know, if you're along there aside a Werewolf in London and Child's Play and Arachnophobia, I think that's pretty decent, to be honest.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, with that being said, let's dive straight into it then. And in today's show, we are talking about Tenenbaum.
Captain Schiavone, Homicide Squad. The book deals with a murder committed with an old-fashioned open razor.
Wish I'd never written that book.
Probably help if I brought my notes up. This movie was released in 1982, was directed by Dario Argento, and stars Anthony Franciosa, Giuliano Gemma, and John Saxon. My pronunciation, I was practicing that in my head all for about an hour before we came on there. I just find John Saxon a really difficult name to say.
I love John Saxon so much, so that's a little indication that if there's a John Saxon movie and I can fit it in, I will.
I love him.
He's one of my granddaddy.
I think this
guys.
Is only the second John Saxon movie we've covered. So I think this and
that's got to be fixed.
This and Nightmare on Elm Street, I believe, are the the only two that we've actually covered. So yeah, that's definitely something that we can fix moving forward. The IMDb plot is as follows. An American novelist visiting Rome to promote his latest book is stopped and harassed by an obsessed fan who is committing a string of murders that appear to be tributes to his work. So, Candy. Obviously, we've kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, you'd be false advertising if for your first pick you didn't pick, you know, Argento or something Italian or some giallo. What attracts you to these movies? Tell us about your love affair with Argento and an Italian horror, because I want to get a little bit of, I want our listeners to get a little bit of background on that.
Well, I want to start by explaining what a giallo movie is, because there's Italian horror and there's giallo. Italian horror would be more like Fulci type stuff. Mm-hmm. Giallo is it means yellow in Italian. And the crime novels back in the day, you know, like 30s and 40s and stuff like that, they were done in these yellow books because they were kind of like trashy. You know, these sort of murder mysteries where we really don't find out who the killer is till the end. That is a specific, that's what a giallo is. And that's, the giallos gave birth to the American slasher film. So I love giallo films because, and this movie is kind of in a weird way a spoof of, and also at the same time, an actual giallo film. Dario Argento is known for bringing giallo films to the mainstream. It really started with Mario Bava and The Girl Who Knew Too Much, which also John Saxon was in. Black and White, I mean, he had a long career. Can't believe he's gone. So, you know, with there's certain things that are specific to a giallo film, like point of view kills. When we see like early slashers like Sleepaway Camp, the first Friday the 13th, stuff like that, it has these very specific point of view kills. Oh, it's you. Oh, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you really don't find out, you know, it's, there's a big twist in the third act of like, who's the killer. And like I said, I don't really love Argento movies overall because of, it changed what giallo is. They added a supernatural element. So it is more famous stuff like Suspiria, which I'm not a huge fan of Suspiria. I know. A lot of shit for that. I actually like Suspiria 2018, and I think we'll have to talk about that sometime soon. But, you know, that had, like, you know, witchcraft, a lot of his stuff, like Deep Red. There are certain supernatural aspects, but this is a straight giallo, just humans, crime story, lots of gore. I mean, it is exactly the definition of a giallo film. So I got really into it because, you know, after you grew up in video stores and you worked in video stores, you've seen everything. And I started just really looking for other things to watch. So that kind of left these weird movies, different kinds of movies. And then, you know, Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs came on, believe in 1998 on TNT here in the States. And he would show some kind of B movies or wild kind of different things. And in his books, he wrote like Joe Bob Goes to the Drive-In, Joe Bob Goes Back to the Drive-In, which are extremely hard to find because they're out of print, but I have them and I have them signed by him. But he covered this as Unsane, which is how it was released in the US, which was cut way down. So I had to see the original film, and Joe Bob recently covered it maybe a year or two ago on The Last Drive-In, and it got me like back into the film, like, oh man, I forgot how much I really fucking love this movie. But yeah, so like me and Italian horror specifically, and you know, these giallo films, they're just something I really, really enjoy because of the gores, because of you know, the twists. I love the twists. Not an M. Night Shyamalan twist, like a real fucking twist.
Yeah.
Like that will fucking flip you out, because, you know, Detective Germani, who I love in this movie, who plays like, you know, the main guy working on these murders, he's like, you know, they make a lot of references to like the Hound of Baskervilles and stuff by like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, like, you know, Sherlock Holmes stuff. And he says, I can never figure out the killer. Now, I think that's interesting for a police captain who likes murders, who's, you know, like interested in them anyway, and he's solving them, but he can never figure out who the killer is. And so there's that little spoof there. You know, so this is a fun one.
Yeah. excuse me. I really like that fact, like thing you said, that you said, oh, it says, oh, I can never sort of figure out who the killer is. But, you know, near the end of this movie, when he's like, oh, I've just finished reading your book and I figured out who the killer was on page 30. You know,
right.
I love that. And I was, I almost hoped it was like a nod to maybe he'd figured out that it was Peter that was the killer.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's like, that was a really exciting one for me. So yeah, I really love that. You know, we talk about police officers in horror movies and their levels of ability.
Yeah, they're not always the brightest.
They're not. At least these ones seem intelligent. I mean, they're not particularly good detectives, but...
No, I mean, with Jermani saying like, yeah, I could never figure out who the killer is, it's kind of like, so what's your record like as a homicide detective, bro?
Well, I think it all gets summed up when he's like, when he tells his Anne earlier in the movie that he only drinks on duty.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's the other scene where
endearing character.
Yeah, like, there's another scene where
like the guy,
you know, when they're chasing the killer in the street and the other detective causes a car to crash. And she just sort of looks at the car and just runs away. And it's just like,
yeah,
you've just made this guy crash. You know, you've not caught the killer. Maybe go see if he's okay.
Yeah, and they're just kind of, and they laugh about it, you know. And he's like, you know, I should have like a male, you know, partner, you know. And then she's like, well, then what would you bitch about? You know, so it's kind of, you know, there's this rapport between them. And she's not a terribly, like, important or big character in this, but it does add a little aspect of, like, what we're working with here.
Well, I think for this movie as well, and, you know, sort of doing a bit of research and looking up at things and just from sort of picking up on my own sort of things, it's the detectives, they reflect, don't they, our other characters on the side, Peter and... her name's just completely Anne. Peter and Anne.
Yeah.
Sorry, my brains and names are just...
And that's Daria Nicolodi, who was his wife at the time.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, she was, and she helped write Suspiria and stuff like that. But I think she's great in Tenebrae. Like, I really think she does an amazing job. And I think she is so beautiful. And actually, Argento's career went kind of downhill very quickly when they divorced.
Well, I mean, she gives a very layered performance in this as well. You know, I think an issue for a lot of people, because one of the things I was going to say to you is, you know, why do we think that, you know, these movies are sort of seen to be niche and, you know, it's not, maybe not amongst sort of wider, but even just within the horror community itself, everyone sort of appreciates, you know, Argento's career and appreciates the subgenre and, you know, and things like that.
He's the Stanley Kubrick of Italian horror, you know, he's a little up his own ass.
Yeah, but, you know, I think...
He's respected.
Yeah, 100%. But it's still, like you say, very much considered to be a niche subgenre. And I was just sort of wondering, you know, why people maybe think that. Because when you sit and you know, and I sat and watched Tenebrae again earlier today, just so it was nice and fresh in my brain. And I was sitting and I was looking at it and I was thinking, there's nothing really in here that isn't in every other mainstream horror movie. You know, like I don't know if it's maybe like the foreign element of it, because, you know, a lot of people...
That's exactly what it is, though, because a lot of people, you know, when I start talking about, you know, maybe at a con or I meet people and I start talking about how I love giallo films and they're like, okay, what is that?
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, those Italian horror films. And I'm like, and they're usually like, those are crap. You know, but I think it's the people that don't want to sit through, even though it's dubbed. And you can, you know, on certain features, like I have this really amazing copy that has the Unsane cut, that has the Argento cut, that has, you know, all the extra features and stuff on it. So it's like a 3-disc set, Blu-ray set. It's just that I think people are immediately, just like some people are immediately like, oh, a movie's in black and white. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to watch that. So I feel like it's more of that kind of thing, because some people just immediately dismiss it. Like, I'm not going to watch a foreign, you know, and this is speaking, you know, as an American and what I've encountered as an American. So other Americans are kind of like, yeah, no. I mean, you have your people who are really into it, but they're rare. It's just such a niche thing. It shouldn't be. You're absolutely right, especially because it gave us the slasher. And this movie in particular is very famous within that subgenre. Mm-hmm. This is one of those, oh, Argento did it. And it's usually mentioned right after Suspiria. Like, oh, I love Suspiria. And at least everybody's seen Suspiria. But I'm like, if you've seen Suspiria, go one more and watch Tenebrae. Like, come on, man. Tenebrae is better.
Yeah. I think, you know, I think we've hit the nail on the head there. There is just a certain group of people out there who will think, who hear the words foreign movie or foreign language movie and just go, oh, I'm not watching that. They don't want to sit and read subtitles. They don't want to watch, like you say, something that's generally not the greatest dubbed. Just for reference point, I did watch the dubbed version for this earlier today, just so that I didn't have to focus too much, because I was taking notes at the same time as well. So I wanted to watch the English version. But there is like that, you know, I remember, like, we obviously covered a lot of shows across podcasts, and, you know, unless something is from the US, from the UK or Canada or Australia, unless it's from these countries, they just like, no, that's it. I'm not going to watch them. And you know as well as I do,
speaking countries, basically.
Yeah, you know as well as I do as well, even outside sort of Italian horror as well. You know, French horror is got some incredible movies in there. Spanish horror.
Oh, my
horror.
God. The new French Extremity movement is, like, my shit right there.
You know, there's
and
some...
I actually enjoy foreign films, because they'll kind of push the envelope a little bit more. Here we get more of your blockbuster types, like, who hasn't seen Child's Play? Who hasn't seen Jaws? Who hasn't seen The Exorcist? You know, it's kind of like... you're supposed to do that. You're supposed to watch
it. And listen, that's not to downplay those movies, because some of those movies are some of the greatest horror movies of all time, you know? but like you say, I think there is just that sort of general feeling that you can push the envelope a little bit more, wasn't it, with some of these foreign films? Like you say, New French Extremity, go and watch things like Martyrs and, you know...
Or like Inside.
Yeah, you know, and then like I say, there's some really great Spanish stuff out there. There's some really great South American stuff out there.
Yes.
You know, there's some, and obviously, you know, Japanese and Korean horror movies. Like,
God, I love J-horror.
You know, Asian horror. So like, there's, and the fact is, like, there's so many. If you go through all of these sort of regions, and that's just like me picking sort of the main ones off the top of my head, because there's definitely going to be some really great Eastern European horror out there as well, you know, I think. So... you know, you take all these things into factors, and, you know, we've mentioned a couple of the movies, but in there again are some of the greatest horror movies of all time. And I'm saying, like, I'm just putting that straight out there. I think, you know, last time I was on your old show, I think was it Let the Right One In? I think I was
yes,
to talk
yes,
about.
We did.
And
that's that
one of my favorite movies of all time. I love that movie with, like, all my heart. I fucking love that film.
And a lot of people, if it's not dubbed, one, you really can't win. If it is dubbed, they don't like the dubbing.
Yeah.
If it isn't dubbed, they don't want to read the subtitles. Like,
I can't watch British TV or English speaking TV without subtitles these days. I have subtitles on for everything that I watch.
My kids got me into that because they watch everything with subtitles, so I do too. I mean, even just like regular, you know, American shows, like or a movie. Pardon me. But like. They got me into watching that. But it's like, I remember when Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out. And that is one of my favorite movies of all time. And they were, when it was showing in theaters, because it was up for, you know, all these Oscars, they would show the dubbed version and they would show the subbed version. Now, the dubbed version was just packed. Mm-hmm. And I think the dubbing in that is just, it just ruins the story. They changed so much and they even changed the names of the characters.
Yeah.
But when you watch the subbed version, which nobody was in, it was just me and my brother. It was just like, there's something magical about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it comes down to a personality type, what you are into, what you're willing to do for a film.
I think there's always, you know, like, There's a little bit of suspicion, isn't there? A little bit of like, I don't know if animosity is the word I'm looking for, but you're just a little suspicious that of a dubbed version that there are aspects of the story being changed. You know, are we missing things that we may not have missed if we watched the subbed version? You know, I think there's just a little bit of reluctance on people's behalf to really sort of accept a dubbed version for what it is.
Well, and when, you know, Giallo was really popular, we're talking like during the 70s, a little bit in the 60s with Bava, who kind of started the Giallo movement. But like, you know, as you go into like the 80s and stuff, and then that just kind of died off, the Giallo thing did, because the slasher took over. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you lose something. And it's... I love them with slashers, but you know, we need these Giallo films. And the cool thing is about when these movies are dubbed, because they want them to sell in America. Yeah. Because they're going to make bank. It's so much cheaper to shoot overseas. And then, you know, these actors who do the dubbing, there's only like 10 of them who do it over and over for every movie.
Yeah.
So like, there's a funny thing about a Fulci film called House by the Cemetery, where the kid Bob, I'm you've seen it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that kid Bob is so fucking annoying because of his voice. One who names their little son Bob?
Okay. Maybe anyway. It may be Robert. It could be Robert.
Yeah, but they call him Bob. And Fulci loves to use the name Bob, and it's in City of the Living Dead as well. But anyway, so Bob, his voice is so annoying, and everybody's like, I wish that kid, like when Joe Bob showed it and people were live tweeting, they were like, I wish Bob would just get killed. I'm just sick of Bob. Because it's a woman doing an imitation of a child's voice.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, you know, you only have this very small pool of people who were dubbing all of these Giallo and Italian horror movies. So, you know, you would recognize the voices, and sometimes the voices don't really fit.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, with Argento, he speaks English quite well.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of dubbing in Tenebrae.
No, and what is there is done to a reasonably good standard as well. There's no...
Like Dario Nicolodi.
Yeah, like you can obviously you can tell, because, you know, it is... It's really, really difficult to get a different person's voice to match the face of someone else,
yeah, and
match
like, the movements of like someone actress, else. I don't have her name written down, but Jane, the mysterious Jane, yeah. In this. You could tell that she's dubbed, but it's not badly done. It works.
No, it's generally like I think it's absolutely fine in this movie. It's like you say, it's of course, you know, if you watch a badly dubbed film, then yeah, it does. It can totally ruin the experience. It can totally just take you out of anything.
Or it can make it really, really funny, like a Fulci film. But the difference between, you know, people considered Fulci and Argento rivals, but they made two different kinds of films. I think Fulci only did like maybe one or two Giallo films. One being Don't Torture a Duckling, which is great. But he mostly went into like gore films. He's called the godfather of gore. Him and Herschel Gordon Lewis, which is weird that they both have that title. But, you know, Argento was much more artsy. And, you know, so they weren't really rivals. But, you know, Argento was actually like a really good dude. He's a really good guy. Mm-hmm. Still around. When Fulci's career failed and he was dying, Argento paid for his funeral costs and his medical care. So, you know, he's got that going for him.
I think it's a respect thing as well, isn't it? You know, we can all sit here and be like, oh, you know, pitting horror directors against each other and actors and characters and blah, 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 and whatever you want. At the end of the day, they're all part of the same community. You know, they're all...
Exactly. And I mean, it is a respect that I think as Americans we lack.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have the respect for our elders.
I wouldn't just say Americans as well. I would say people, you know, from the UK too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we, you know, everyone in the UK, we really love to go America bashing here in the UK and be like, oh, well, it's fine, you know, we're not as
rude. Us Americans do too, because you know? We're not really happy with how things are going, but.
but no, you know, I think we can be just as bad as well at times, so. Definitely.
I thought it was important just to get that information out there before we start discussing the film, like what a Giallo is.
Yeah.
That there's a whole subgenre of just movies waiting for you to check them out. And this is a good starter.
Yeah, I would probably say one of the best ways to get into it as well would be to watch this one. Because I actually think this is a really And this is a compliment. This does maybe doesn't sound like a compliment, but I actually just think this is a really easy watch as well.
It is.
You know, you don't have to. You get drawn in by the mystery, by the crime aspect of it. And to be honest with you, I love a good whodunit. You know, I love a movie where there's like a mystery element where you are waiting to find out who it is. You know, as long as
there's going to be some wild twist.
There's going to be a
and
reveal.
And you're kind of thinking, like, what's the twist in this one? But when it happens, you're just like, holy shit, that third act is crazy.
Let's just go straight into it then with the twist. Because I, for one, I remember my first watch, I certainly didn't see that coming. You know, I didn't see the fact that, you know, Peter was the... But there's a sort of twist within the twist, isn't there? Because, you know, the reveal that Peter's the killer, but if he wasn't the original killer
was... Right, and
that's
where they get you.
Yeah, the original killer was Cristiano.
When he shows up in Rome, he gets that letter.
Yeah.
And there's already been a murder.
Mm-hmm.
Where the woman tried to steal the book and then she was going to pay for it with sex, which I'm like, okay, girl, I love to read. But I'm not paying for a book with sex. Like, are you out of your fucking mind?
She was really quick to just, like, give up her address there.
And also, you know, and there's a lot of commentary in this if you kind of know your history here, but Argento was, you know, a lot of people said he was a misogynist. Through some of his films, you know, because he had quite a few films under his belt at this point, because he started very young, making films like Bird with the Crystal Plumage, which is first, and that's an amazing movie. But, like, so he really kind of upped the ante and said, oh, you think I'm a misogynist? All these women, they don't get killed till they're practically naked.
Yeah.
They're always changing clothes, you know, and so there's this neat little commentary, like, oh well, I'm gonna just lean into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of commentary in this movie as well, though, if you go look through it, because, you know, we kind of sort of talked about a little, very briefly there about duality, but there, you know, there is also that conversation that goes on between Cristiano and Peter, you know, just before they go and do their TV interview as well, where they're talking about, you know, religion and, you know, people, you know,
morally
and social deviancy, and, you know, there's
sexual deviancy
and
yes.
You know, there's a lot in this movie about things like, you know, prostitution, because you see that quite a lot. And, you know, Italy at that time was a very conservative place, so
yes,
you know, there's also a trans actor in this movie as well.
Yes,
you know?
I was gonna say, how forward thinking was that, because we get these flashbacks of a woman in heels and surrounded by men. And at one point she, like, you know, basically sticks, you know, the heel in this guy's mouth before, like, kicking him and fucking him up. But it is a trans actor, mm-hmm. and beautiful, beautiful woman.
Oh,
you would never
stunning.
Know that without, you would never know that this is a trans woman without, you know, looking it up.
Yeah. 100%. No, you absolutely wouldn't. But that's what I said. So, you know, it just, like you say, and you also have that scene earlier as well between Peter and Tilda, where she's obviously sitting there and she's accusing him of, you know, being a misogynist and the sexism in the books that he writes. And obviously that's Dirk Argento there being like, you know, this is what I've been receiving, so almost. So here we go.
And also,
here's this movie.
Based on the fact that he did have a stalker when he was in New York. So it was kind of pulling from his life, making light of some jokes or some commentary said about his films. You know, there's a lot of that in there that kind of it's funny while being, you know, serious. And another thing about Giallos is there's always a red herring, mm-hmm. You know, like any good mystery. So they're good crime mystery stories. So with Peter showing up in Rome and, you know, he set his bag down at the airport. Why the fuck would you do that and walk away from it? Like, I don't know.
It was the 80s. 9/11 hadn't happened yet.
Yeah. I mean, but even in 1982, like, I was two. probably three or two, one of those. You know, even I would know you don't set your bag down and walk away from it. You know, because one thing back then in airports, they would be like, has your bag been out of your possession?
Yeah.
So his clothes are all slashed. He has this letter stuck under the door. Detective Germani's there, like, there's been this murder. I know you didn't do it because you just showed up here, but it has to do with your book. Pages of your own book, Tenebrae, that he had written, was shoved in her mouth, and she died basically of suffocation, but a straight razor was taken to her as well. Mm-hmm. And as, of course, she was getting naked. So, you know, so we've got that right off the bat. We're immediately dismissing the fact that Peter, he couldn't have done that. There's literally no way.
Yeah.
There's literally no way. It's impossible. So you're kind of like, all right, well, so we're going to meet the killer then. And it's going to be somebody we're not expecting.
It's almost like it's a double red herring as well, because obviously they then come up with this theory in the middle that Cristiano is the killer, and, you know, Peter and
Johnny,
they go to the house to sort of find out who it is, and, you know, they obviously try and confront him, and then he gets killed. So, and then you're sort of thinking, well, maybe he wasn't the killer, and this is still the same killer, you know, running all the way through. You know, and then obviously you get the reveal again that, yeah, no, in actual fact, Cristiano was the original killer. It was Peter. Because then Peter obviously is not seen whilst Cristiano is being killed. He's out the sight of Gianni too. And then we come back to him, you know, sort of unconscious on the grass.
Yeah, he's been hit with a rock.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh no, what happened, Johnny? Like, what did you see?
Yeah.
You know, but we realize, you know, upon a second watching, like, he's more going, what did you see? Did you see me in there with an axe?
Yeah.
But, you know, like, what did you see? Because I was knocked out. You know, so he's hit himself in the head, you know, because he's decided, hey, I kind of like what Christiana's doing. I'm going to fucking do it too. I'm going to start over, because he's right about this book. This book is about those things and these weird memories with this kind of creepy carnival music, going over them with the transgender actor with the red heels. Mm-hmm. The red heels are kind of symbolic. So, I mean, it's just sort of like, so nobody sees that coming, because you're like, well, now he's dead, but the murders are still happening. And then there's this whole like bait and switch, like, I'm going to fly out because it's not safe for me here.
Yeah.
Germani's like, yeah, you need to get out of here. It's not safe for you. But he's thinking, oh, fuck, I just got away with it. Mm-hmm. You know, I just got away with this thing. And, you know, but he's counting on Johnny not remembering.
Yeah. I really,
are you sure you don't remember anything? Or, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And obviously when Johnny decides to go back to the house later, that's obviously when, you know, Peter decides, well, this kid's got to go as well. You know, because he's trying to figure out what's actually going on. So, you know, when you sit and you think about the mystery, because, like, I think I remember the first or second time I was watching this, and I couldn't quite put certain pieces in all the places yet. It was like I was following along with the mystery, you know, and you're just like, I can't quite figure out, like, why certain things are happening and in the order they're happening. But obviously through multiple rewatches, that's why, because, you know,
it's definitely like a think piece. Like, you want to go back and watch it because you're like, what did I miss?
Yeah.
And you do miss these little details that upon rewatching, you're like, oh shit. And what it's neat, I think, that Argento included was, we've got Peter reading The Hound of the Baskervilles by, you know, a Sherlock Holmes novel by Arthur Conan Doyle. And then Detective Jemani mentioned it. But when we have the girl, and I can't remember her name. Oh my God, Maria, maybe. That was kind of messed around with Johnny a little bit.
Yeah.
The young girl, because he called her specifically jailbait.
Yeah.
Peter did.
He did.
Yeah. But why does she fuck with that dog?
Well, that was like, I don't.
That,
like,
dog was fucking pure evil.
She's like trying to, like, hit a stick at the fence with it, and she's just irritating it even more. Like, a dog comes up to the fence and starts barking at you like that, you're just moving on.
I would run away. I mean, I've never had a dog, and I was attacked by a German Shepherd when I was a kid. I mean, I do like dogs. I like all animals, but yeah. I will never have a dog. I have cats, but that dog barked and scared me like that. I understand that she was angry in that moment because, you know, she got off the motorbike and she's like, yeah, fuck you, basically.
That's not Johnny on the motorbike, though.
But it's not Johnny, exactly.
So I'm a little confused.
She left with him, but it's not him.
Yeah, so is that... And are we just sort of like... This is sort of one of the things, you know, that I kind of wrote down about this, you know. The storytelling in these movies is different to traditional storytelling. There's a lot, there's so much that we don't get, you know, in a lot of movies, they really are at pains to say, this is who this person is, this is why this person's relevant, this is their purpose. You know,
it
this
kind
is
of
the
walks you through and holds your hand
yeah.
in other movies.
Whereas,
I like when my hand isn't held, like when I get to figure it out myself.
Yeah, and not only
I like
that, you
that.
know, we'll never know who that person actually was that she got off the motorbike from, but we can create some sort of backstory towards that. You know, we could say,
yeah, some guy she was dating and she wanted to go do something and he didn't want to. They have an argument and she's pissed.
Yeah,
She gets off the
and
bike.
you know, that's just one example of it in this movie as well. Obviously, you've also got this whole sort of history here between Peter and his ex. Is it his ex-wife, right? They were married.
They don't really specify whether it's his ex-girlfriend or his ex-wife.
Yeah.
I always kind of took it as his ex-wife.
Yeah, that's
Jade's
how
a
I
little
took it.
fucking weird. I mean, I think they make her weird on purpose. So
Yeah.
you're like suspicious of Jane because she obviously, you know, fucked up his clothes and his bag. Like she's still, you think, hung up on him.
But this
but
is the thing as well, though, because
be
I think this
different.
Can be a commentary on relationships as well, because here you have this sort of ex-partner in Jane, and, you know, she's being portrayed as just being this sort of mad character who's, you know,
yeah, very
obsessed
unhinged.
And unhinged and, you know, slashing up clothes. And the whole movie is just sort of, whenever she appears, is about focusing on what she did to him. You know, what did she, like, what she did to him, and even Anne says it, you know, how can you, like, can't forgive her for what she did to you in New York, or something along those lines. And then we get this big reveal at the end, and I we'll obviously talk again about the last scene, but I love the mania that Peter shows in that final scene, you know, where he's finally discovered. But then that leads us to think, well, did Jane actually do anything to him? Was it a case of, you know, he was this crazed character, this crazed person, and she was trying to just escape from him? There's always two sides.
Bulmer, who is played by John Saxon, who I love, who's his his agent?
His agent, yeah.
And I wanted to say editor, but his agent. And he's in Rome. Mm-hmm. And you're like, why the fuck is Jane in Rome before we know anything about her and Bulmer? Because, you know, Bulmer's this fun kind of goofy character. Like, what do you think about the hat?
Yeah,
and,
there's a whole scene,
you know,
about how
the
hats
fucking
work.
Hat. But, you know, he's kind of, you know, handling sort of the press things. Here, you got to talk to this person, you know, your book's selling really well here, but we've got to work this. You got to do this interview. You got to go on TV. But it turns out that Jane's in Rome because she's having an affair with Bulmer.
Yeah.
But for some reason, they don't want, and we don't really know why the first watch, why Jane and Bulmer would hide that from Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that a secret?
Well, and my taking of it is then it's a secret because, you know, he's obviously displayed these characteristics previously of, you know, whatever, you know, disorder or issue that he actually suffers from, whether that's, you know, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or, you know, any other sort of mental disorder that he may have.
Absolutely. He's got something going on there.
He's very clearly in my mind, has displayed that previously during the relationship. So they're rather than, because initially you would think they just don't want to tell him because it's his ex-wife and that's really sort of not, you know, you're probably really shouldn't do that to your friends, you know, like there's the code, isn't there, you know, the
right.
boy/girl code, however you want to call it, you know, you don't sleep with your friends as, you know, ex-partners and things like that, and it's stupid, but, you know, it's sort of like a moralistic thing, isn't it, you know. So I, you know, initially would probably just put it down to that, but now I would put it down to the fact of an actual fact, I think they're actually scared of him.
Yeah, I think Jane's absolutely scared of him. But you assume first off that Jane is there because of her obsession with Peter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that at all. She's there because, like, at one point Peter goes in and talks to Bulmer, and Jane is sort of hiding.
Yeah, she's hiding in, like, this hidden cupboard, isn't she?
Yeah, sort of like a little closet area. And she comes out, like, is he gone? Okay, cool. And then, you know, they're all, like, professing their love for each other. And, hey, you going to meet me for lunch again at the same place? And, you know, stuff like that. And, yeah, of course. But the thing is, like, she goes and she gets she goes home and there's this box. Mm-hmm. And the box has the red high heels in them. Obviously not the same pair of the red high heels that we're getting in these flashbacks, but very similar. Like, hey, I want you to wear these shoes. And she probably assumes, I mean, the way I took it was that they were from Bulmer. Like, hey, I got you some nice new shoes to wear for our little luncheon thingy that we're doing in this big, you know, square where we meet up, you know, and it's a nice piece of, you know, Roman architecture there. It's a cool, like, little square area. I love it. But the thing is, and I know it's done for art, and I have to talk about something else that's done for art in just a second. The crane shot. We'll get there.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of famous for this movie. People have watched it. But so Bulmer's waiting, and someone just comes up and stabs him. I mean, it's our point of view shot with the black gloves, which is kind of an Argento.
Yeah.
You know, telltale, like, calling card kind of thing. But, like, it's in front of all those people. And then you see the red high heels walk up, so you know it's Jane. Mm-hmm. And then she quickly runs away when she sees that Bulmer's dead.
Yeah, that scene has always sort of confused me a little bit, because this is in broad daylight. There's a lot of people going around. There were kids, there's children.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't a sly murder. It wasn't a particularly public death. It was very much just, I've walked up to you and I'm about to stab you.
Could that be attributed to the fact that Peter is becoming more and more unhinged?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I think so.
It's one of those things, you create delusions of grandeur as well, don't you? You know, this could be a thing of, well, you know what, I'm getting away with this, so I can be bolder, I can be braver, and to the point where
because Germani hadn't figured out who any of these people, you know, that Cristiano was killing.
Yeah.
And he's like trying to protect Peter because he thinks Peter's in danger. Mm-hmm. And so Peter's like, man, I got this. But, like, the fact that Jane, you know, you see her shoes in those red shoes. Like, we don't ever see her face.
Yeah.
You see her shoes walk up to meet him and then sees that he's dead and then runs away. Which means, like you said, that he's probably displayed this before. And we get these weird little intercuts of scenes. They're very brief, of a man screaming and taking pills.
Yeah.
At a couple different times. And, you know, you know, like, okay, that's our killer. But who is it?
Yeah.
Because we can't see. It's obscured by, like, a glass wall that's kind of mottled. You know, you can't really see who it is.
You know, and I think as well, you know, when we get the big reveal with Peter, you know, it is almost, like, a little difficult to process. Because throughout the movie, you know, you play, like, like you say, you get that immediate sort of dismissal of him from the very get-go. You know, he's just arrived. So throughout, you know, we have zero suspicion of him whatsoever. Like, none.
Right.
You know, and you'll know as well, like, for as horror fans, we are always, you know, suspicious of everyone in these kinds of films. You know, there's never anyone who's off limits. Everyone's always a suspect.
Right, and especially in a giallo film, because you have to expect they're going to at least show the killer at least once on the mm-hmm. screen. And it's not, it might be somebody that we didn't really get to know, but was there or just had a yeah. minor role. But no, this was completely subverted.
Yeah. But the thing is, you know, we're not suspecting them because we have just accepted. We've been told, this movie has literally told us, he cannot be the killer because of this. We have the evidence to back up that he cannot be the killer. So in our heads, we're going, no, it's not him. I can see why. Like, it couldn't possibly be him. You know, for it to have been him, there must be some sort of massive plot hole.
But he has a couple of telltale signs
yeah.
that it is him after a bit. Because when Cristiano was still alive before Peter kills him, he's getting these letters and these, like, yellow envelopes, and Germani's kind of keeping an eye on them. He's handing them to Germani. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what the hell is going on. But once Cristiano is dead, they stop coming.
Yeah.
There's no more letters. And Germani's like, huh, that's weird. And Germani has already said, like, yeah, I already figured out who the killer was on page 30 on your new book. So, you know, I'm good. I'm good at this. I'm good at what I'm doing. And really thinks he's doing the right thing in protecting Peter. So Peter, it's almost like a duality, like I think that you mentioned. Like, but I have an interesting question to pose to you,
okay.
because Cristiano was talking about the, you know, sexual perversions and deviations, you know, sexual deviance can be, you know, at one point were known as homosexuals. So we've got the lesbian couple.
Yeah.
And they get murdered in this really, you know, this house. And it's funny because this is so Argento of him, for Argento to order the crane, spend millions of dollars having it shipped over from France just to do a 3-minute scene with, okay, honestly, and this is going to get me a lot of hate. I like the soundtrack to Tenebrae better than I like the soundtrack to Suspiria. Suspiria is considered like the gold standard, yeah. But I really love the Tenebrae song. And so it's like this 3-minute shot of like the women dead, you know, of course, both, you know, mostly naked. Mm-hmm. And one does the trademark, you know, head hanging out the window, yeah. Also an Argento calling card. But it's just playing the song, going over the roof tiles really slow, like doing this whole sort of look. And it's like, was that really worth several million dollars, though? I don't know.
I think so.
I think it's a cool thing, but it's something that a lot of people who are fans of the movie do question. I like it.
I think
because I like the song.
I get why people question it because a lot of it seems a bit unnecessary. I think it's indulgence, isn't it? It's that overindulgence on what it is. But that's one of the reasons why I think I love this movie because, you know, it does overindulge in itself sometimes, and that's one of the sort of prime examples. Like you say, the score for this movie is absolutely fantastic. It goes throughout the entire film. You know, and
it's,
I think,
mostly it's all of Goblin except Argento. Yeah. So it's, you know, Claudio Simonetti who did this one, but he's also part of Goblin. And speaking of Goblin, they famously did the soundtrack for Romero's Dawn of the Dead because Romero didn't have the funds to make Dawn of the Dead. Argento produced it, yeah. And it was called Zombie in Italy. And that's why when Fulci did his zombie movie, it's called Zombie 2.
Yeah.
But like Goblin did the music for Dawn of the Dead, so there's a lot of leftover Goblin music used in some of these scenes. And if you watch Dawn of the Dead a million times, like I have, you can pick it up. You're like, oh, that's from Dawn of the Dead. That's from the mall. That's from Dawn of the Dead. But then you've got this great Tenebrae song that's kind of got a little disco, a little prog rock, a little. That song is a fucking jam. I play it all the time on Spotify. It's like my fucking jam. So I do like the crane shot because we get that song. We get this sort of like, yeah, shit's about to get real crazy. Kind of like, so it's going slow to show you shit's going to get sped up. Things are going to happen.
Like I say, I think it's an indulgence thing. I think it's something that a lot of horror movies don't do enough of sometimes. I think we get it a lot with like A24 style movies, you know, when people are like, oh, elevated horror. You know, these are the kinds of movies that tend to do this sort of thing where they overindulge. When we, as well, when me and, you know, when me and, when we had Newman on the show from Movies for Days and we were talking about Mandy, you know, that's a movie that really indulges itself in color and its shots and, you know, the score, like that's the most of the movie, and we love it for it. And I think this is a really great example of that here as well. So, you know, I'm all for that big long crane shot. I think it's great. I think it really adds to, I mean, it doesn't add anything plot wise to the story.
No, like, but absolutely does it look really cool and but sound it's really just cool?
Fucking,
it does.
Yeah, it's just fucking cool as shit.
Because we get to see the gory death. Because you know, giallos have a lot of gore in them. And actually, there's a very famous scene in this, a death scene, that is Quentin Tarantino's favorite death scene of all time.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, there at that third act that goes completely just like up to 11. That third act is just twist, 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 craziness, twist, twist, twist. It's so much. Pays off.
I want to just sort of briefly go back to a point that we've kind of made, because I've got like a little addition to it. So we're going back again to talk about this relationship between Peter and Jane, his ex-partner.
Right.
You know, and we've obviously theorized that, you know, he's maybe displayed some of these sort of psychotic, you know, behaviors previously, before, you know, they came to Rome. We don't know obviously the full time scale of the thing, but there's also this sort of relationship between Peter and Anne in this movie. Now there is a scene where Peter specifically says, oh, we've known each other for 6 years, this is the first time we'll ever share a room together or spend the night or something like that. I think it's spend the night he says.
Yeah. It was the first time we've ever spent the night together. And then, you know, he kisses her very romantically. And it's like, and she's like, hey, you know, we'll do this, but it never happened.
Yeah.
But you could tell that she's into him,
Do you
you
also
know.
therefore think, though, that that's something that Jane maybe had been jealous of or paranoid about in a previous in their previous relationship? Because
Yeah, and
obviously
also
there is this.
you've got Peter, who's probably telling Anne, who's, you know, very close to Anne, who's probably telling Anne maybe some falsehoods about Jane. So, you know, Anne seems very put out about her, you know, annoyed with her. But maybe it's because of the things that Peter told
Yeah.
her.
But, you know, Peter's obviously like, yeah, 100%. And then, you know, Jane's obviously on the maybe the other side of it, where, you know, Peter, she's maybe being suspicious of their relationship. There's very clearly been, you know, some sort of spark between Peter and Anne prior to this, because it doesn't, you don't just suddenly go, oh, we've known each other for 6 years, click, okay, like now we're going to sleep together.
Yeah, I mean, you see a closeness between them that's immediate. You know, you see that she's instantly like, you know, looking after him, taking care of him. Let me get you a drink. Let me do
Yeah.
this for you. Let's get you writing. Let's do this. Let's do that. She's just very close with him in a way that seems more than friends. Like that she's definitely got a thing for him. But maybe he doesn't quite know it. I don't know.
And listen, also, you know, that line, you know, 6 years and we've never spent the night together. That doesn't mean that they haven't had some sort of physical relationship
This is true.
prior to that as well. You know, that can mean a whole variety of things. So there could
And
be
it
some.
could mean that they've done, you know, they've had sex before and she's been like, this never happened.
Yeah. So, you
Because
know.
maybe she's afraid to get involved with him. For her own reasons, or maybe she's just, you know, not into commitment. Who knows? But she definitely has a thing for him, and it's absolutely possible that, you know,
Yeah, that could be
they
this.
have been involved.
Yeah, and then obviously as well that then leads to possibly the breakup between, you know, the breakup between Peter and Jane, the animosity there is between Jane and Anne, you know, there because you can really set you can really feel it, you know, when she's the when she,
Especially from Anne.
yeah.
Jane doesn't seem to have it because when Jane's getting ready to kill herself after Bulmer gets murdered, she calls Anne. She's like, hey, I can't be alone or I'm going to kill myself. Can you please come over? And Anne's like, okay,
Yeah.
I guess.
Okay. I want to go back into this final scene. So obviously we get this big reveal that Peter's the killer, and then, you know, he kills the detective. You know, we get so he thinks it's Anne that he's killed. So we get that sort of moment where he's like really remorseful of what he's done. But then we get this, like I sort of alluded to earlier, this really sort of manic performance from him, you know, where he's sort of huddled and crouched in
Anthony
the
Franciosa is a fucking amazing actor.
Yeah, where he's sort of crouching in the corner, and then, you know, he's really remorseful at one point, and then the next moment he's laughing and smile.
Yeah, he was like crying and rocking, then he's laughing. It's the full scale of just every emotion.
And then you get this moment as well where obviously it's time to take this guy in. He needs to come and he needs to be arrested, and he kills himself. And I'm for
And
those
it
who are
takes a
not.
straight razor to his throat, and it's really good gore.
Yeah.
It's really well done. And this is after, you know, he's killed Jane, and that famous scene that Quentin Tarantino loves, with her death because she's in that white dress with the white wall, cuts her arm off, and she just kind of like paints the wall with the blood spurting.
That's
And
very
yeah,
Tarantino,
that
isn't
is very Tarantino. And you know, the thing about Tarantino is why he's good is because he's seen a lot of movies. Like me, he kind of grew up around watching a lot of movies and then worked in video stores. So he's one of those like me who's seen kind of everything, but he uses them in his own films in creative ways that feel fresh, but also pay tribute. So, you know, that is it's amazing that like just knowing and people are so crazy about Quentin Tarantino, myself included. I love his films. Not so much into his foot thing, but he would love my feet because I wear a size 11 shoe. I've got tall people feet.
I don't know. I'm
unfortunately very short, though.
I'm not into feet at all, but I reckon I would let Salma Hayek put her feet in my mouth.
Pour champagne down the leg into your mouth.
Yeah. I would let her do anything.
But yeah, I mean, it's not for me. But most people who do have a foot fetish tend to like bigger feet. Now my feet aren't wide; they're really narrow, but they're very big. So, like I said, I wear a size 11 shoe, and so I would be just the type of foot for Quentin Tarantino. I actually dated a guy a long time ago who was a foot fetishist.
Oh, really?
And I always wear socks and I collect socks. My socks at least cost about $20 and upwards. I have a collection of just amazing socks. And he would say stuff to me. We dated very briefly because I didn't do any foot shit with him. It was not going to happen, even though he was pushing that direction. I was in my 20s. It was a long time ago. But I would wear socks, you know, even if I didn't have shoes on. And he'd be like, yeah, protect those beautiful feet. And, you know, we'd want to paint my toenails. And then, you know, he was like, only I should see your naked feet. And I'm just like, you know, I don't think this is going to work out because I am not into the foot thing. I mean, and I think that I have very nice feet, even with my disability, which affects my feet. I have permanent plantar fasciitis, so it's very painful for me to walk because of my back. You know, I still have really great feet, but it's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I mean, it sounds like it'd be cool, I guess, if you've got big feet, and because some people are like, oh, man, you got some man feet or something. You got huge feet. But like somebody who's like obsessed with my feet thought they were this beautiful, but it got really weird.
Yeah. No, that's well, obviously no kink shame. We don't kink shame. People are allowed to be, you know, into
absolutely what they want to be into. Yeah, I mean, I'm not kink shaming anybody. Well, I'm saying I don't want to be the recipient of a foot fetish.
I'm really just glad that normally it's Nico that's telling us fetish stories and things on the podcast. I'm really glad that when he's not here, you're really taking that torch. He'll be delighted. He'll be so happy.
It's not a story I've told a lot of people, but it did happen to me. I dated this person. And otherwise, they were a very lovely person.
Most people who have
that was a deal breaker for me. And again, I'm not kink shaming. It's just not for me.
Yeah, no, 100%. And people want to go and do things with each other's feet, as long as everyone, all parties involved,
as long as they're consenting people, that's absolutely fine. Consenting adults, and they want to fuck around with some feet stuff, cool. But I'm not going to do that.
No, same.
I'm not here for that. No. Anyway, I got sidetracked.
So he slits his own throat.
He slits his own throat, basically.
We then get this big reveal that it's a dummy blade.
But the thing is like, okay, so Detective Germani, who, you know, he's kind of a himbo. I think he's cute and he's sweet, but why didn't he check to see if he was dead?
Yeah, didn't check the pulse or nothing. You know, anything like that.
No police procedural was done. No. And he just walks out and he's like, Ann, get in the car. I'm gonna radio this in. And then right before he does, he's like, no, wait a minute. I'm going to go back in there. Like, you know, like the light bulb went on over his head. Now, if the light bulb goes over your head and you like, this guy probably isn't dead, I think that I would stay in the car, radio it in, you know, maybe protect my ass a little bit.
Yeah.
But he goes back in there and...
Because the thing is, as well, at this point, they know who he is. They know he is one of the killers. So there's the mystery element is gone here. So as a police officer, you're right. He should have checked the pulse. He should have made sure that the person was actually dead before leaving the crime scene.
But that takes away our fun ending, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because then obviously he goes back into the house and there's that moment where, you know, we see that the body's gone. And then... I mean, remember the first time watching it, I was confused as well. I was like, it was one of these sorts of things where, you know, we got told right at the start of the movie that he can't be the killer. We just watched him slit his own throat, and the effects on it looked really, really good.
You know, it looked very realistic. He made the gurgling sounds. I mean, it looked really, amazingly well done.
I bought it. I totally bought it.
First time I watched it, absolutely.
And then you find out he's gone, so you're sort of... spending that brief sort of moment that you get in between then, and, you know, obviously him reappearing, you're trying to figure out what the fuck's actually gone on. And then, obviously, we discover this dummy blade. That's a lot of blood to come out of a blade that small, I must just say.
Yeah, but we'll forgive it because it looked cool.
Yeah, it did look cool. And then there's that moment, isn't there, where he just appears behind...
Yeah, and it's so well shot because he stands up and he's like, you know, you can hear him thinking like, fuck, this the guy got me. And then he bends back down and we see that Peter's right behind him.
Yeah.
But you didn't notice that before because it was so perfectly obscured.
Yeah, they framed it absolutely spot on, didn't it? So the point where he is behind him, he is right behind him, but it's almost like they have the same silhouette. So right. That, you know, that you just can't see him. It was beautifully done.
Absolutely. It was remarkably done. And it gives you that little start. Mm. You're like, oh fuck, he's right there. And I want to talk about that ugly, ugly, ugly fucking sculpture. The sculpture is the biggest crime in this movie. Okay. No, but it's not even the first movie that Argento used that sculpture in. I can't recall the other one at the top of my head. Like, is it Deep Red? I don't know. It's used in another Argento film. Mm-hmm. But he uses it here, and he uses it well. Because it's very sharp, and it's metal, and it's, you know, modern art.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of abstract, but it's like a lot of metal jutting out. Like, it could literally kill somebody. Like, looking at it, I'm like, oh, that's dangerous. I wouldn't fuck with that in my house. So as they're wrestling, you know, this sculpture gets knocked over against the door, the front door. And Anne and Argento does this where people can hear stuff from far away, or they remembered whispered conversations they couldn't, like in Suspiria. She's remembering a whispered conversation in the pouring rain that she could not have possibly heard.
Yeah.
So here we have Anne, who's in the car, the cop car, and just thinking, what was that noise? And she goes to investigate. You know, like, there's no way she heard that. But maybe, you know, let's give it the benefit of doubt and she'd say she got suspicious because he's been there for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? It's really annoying because I kind of... Obviously, the sculpture and Anne comes in, and that's how we end up Peter dying, is being impaled by this sculpture, which, again, the effects of that look really great. But I really hate how they ended it with just Anne shrieking repeatedly over and over and over again, because...
But it looks so cool.
Oh, it does. It looks
like the
great.
The rain, and then no, we got the Tenebrae soundtrack, that main theme comes in over it, and it's just, as an ending, it's not the most satisfying because we don't know what happens further.
Yeah.
But it looks really cool. And with giallo films, you have to go with that sometimes. Like,
yeah,
it's really fucking cool, doesn't it?
It's the same reason why we love the big 3-minute-long crane shot, isn't it? Because it's this indulgence of
vision.
It
looks really fucking cool, and it sounds cool, you know?
Yeah, 100%. A question...
It's a gif I use on X all the time, is Anne screaming in the doorway.
A question I have for you. So obviously, you know, we find out about Peter being the second killer in this movie. Do we think he is killed before in America?
Well, I think we know, because in those flashbacks, we start to realize they're Peter's flashbacks, mm-hmm. where the woman or, I don't know if, whatever, the trans woman who was giving sexual favors to men, she turned him down. And then at one point he sees her out and she just kind of like looks at him. And we see her get stabbed. So I think he's put that into his book, Tenebrae, mm-hmm. that is selling so well, that is inspiring these murders. Because, you know, it's being of the sexual deviancy, is there's somebody who will give it up to anybody but him.
Yeah.
And puts her shoe in his mouth.
It's a rejection thing, isn't it? Like, this is a person who cannot deal with rejection. And it just goes back again, because I know we've talked a lot about, like, the style of this movie, and we're talking about the crane shot, and we're talking about that ending shot that looks really good. But this is the thing, I think this is why, you know, this is such a beloved movie amongst that sort of niche horror fan, is because this really isn't style over substance. There's a lot of substance to this movie. Again, you know, going back to those themes that we talk about of, you know, rejection and duality and voyeurism and sexual deviancy and comments on religion and, you know, moral values and conservatism.
And there's also a really cool quote, and I think it's brilliantly written. Because Peter himself is kind of tipping off Germani a little bit. He's like, the truth is, no, I don't have the exact quote written down, but I'm going to give you the gist of it. The truth of the matter is that somebody who is dead is alive, or somebody who should be alive is already dead. Mm-hmm. And then he says, no matter how impossible, whatever is improbable must be the truth.
Yeah. Once you've eliminated all options, something along this line. Once you've eliminated everything, no matter how improbable, the impossible must be true.
Exactly. Something like that. So he's told him whoever is supposed to be alive is now dead, or whoever is supposed to be dead is alive. So he's telling Germani basically everything there. And Germani's kind of being a himbo going, huh, that's neat. You know, not really getting it.
Yeah, it's back to that being sort of that him being that sort of himbo character, isn't it, as well, though? Because he has immense faith in his own abilities, and he does seem to have this sort of ego about him, you know, where he's talking about, you know, oh, I solved the book in 30 pages and this, and so I think there's an element of that in there as well. But again, you know, it's teasing us as well, though, because, you know, not just is he trying to tell this character, you know, oh, by the way, not outright tell him, but giving these hints, you know, I'm the killer. He's giving us those hints as well, and I didn't get it. I certainly didn't get it.
There also could have been a false sense of security in Peter by saying, you know, these things, like one trying to sound, you know, super intelligent, and because, you know, Germani just straight up tells him, you know, early on when he goes to Peter, like, hey, there was this murder because of your book, and you know, you got this note, and we need to talk about this. And, you know, then they kind of get into this, like, some casual conversation, and he's like, yeah, I read a lot of murder mysteries. And then Peter's like, but do you ever figure out the killer? He's like, never. I never do.
Yeah.
So right there, I think, is something that stuck with Peter. Like, I can tell him all this shit, but he never figures out the murderer, does he? But, you know, in this one he does, but just a little too late. A little too late.
Yeah.
Even though Peter's handing them hints.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Okay. I don't really have that much more points to go through. Our last sort of thing that I want to pick up on, and we have sort of alluded to it multiple times throughout the episode, but I want to just spend a quick minute. The effects in this movie are actually fucking great. Like,
phenomenal.
They're so good. You know, and I think that's also something that can sometimes be leveled at these sort of giallo films as well. And people look at, like, Italian films and other horror films and other sort of, especially from this sort of era, especially your sort of lower budget one, you know, they look at effects. The effects in this movie are phenomenal, I think. I think they did a remarkable job.
And what I like about giallo films is there's a mixture of blood. I think Stan Winston really perfected it. Because, you know, I like my effects people.
Yeah.
But, like, you add a little green to the red to make it look more realistic. But giallo films go straight for the red.
Yeah,
they don't try to put the green in. They don't try to make it look realistic. It is a gory spray of, like, red.
Yeah, it's in your face. They're not looking for realism. And this is the thing. And this is why we love these movies as well. Because we forgive the unrealistic nature of the blood color, or, you know, if there is a moment where an effect looks particularly janky, you know that scene where Jane does get her hand cut off, you know, how many times have we seen that sort of thing in a horror movie and it just looks terrible? It really doesn't look good at all. But even if it didn't look good here, we probably forgive it a lot more because it's the unrealistic nature of it as well.
It's very stylistic.
Yeah,
you know, and it's that stylisticness, that art, you know, like, artisticness to it that makes it cool,
mm-hmm.
you know, that makes you go, you know what, this actually kind of works better. I would hate that if it looked, like, more realistically like blood, because it wouldn't look as cool.
It would
you
just
know what I mean?
A, That's the thing as well. These movies are all about the cool factor as well. You know, especially, absolutely. You know, and take that out, you're taking out a huge part of what makes these movies so enjoyable. And listen, that's not to say that the rest of this movie isn't enjoyable. We have, again, alluded to it, the cast, like this great cast in this movie as well.
Absolutely. You know,
the cast's fantastic, the score's fantastic, the effects is fantastic, the great twist. I think it's safe to say that we're pretty high on this film.
Oh yeah, I already knew my score going into this, so and that's not changed at all because
we have been known to talk ourselves up or talk ourselves down.
Yeah, I've talked myself up and down a couple of times, you know? But this one it stayed exactly the same because you're just kind of echoing the very things that I love about this film, and I'm glad that you really enjoyed it, and I'm glad that you saw it, because it's one of those things, like, I get to share this. This is kind of like a little expertise, a little weird niche expertise that I have. And for my fellow John Saxon fans out there, he started in Giallo, and so it wasn't actually that strange for him to be in this.
Yeah.
Because actually, John Saxon speaks Italian. You know, spoke. I'm sorry. I keep forgetting that he's gone. And I get sad again every time. But he spoke fluent Italian.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was in the black and white very first Giallo. So he's like a Giallo legend.
I remember.
But we know him more as like from Nightmare on Elm Street. Enter the Dragon, or, you know, a lot of these other things that he did.
I remember watching this for the first time a while ago, and I'm thinking to myself, that's a really odd casting choice for this movie, John Saxon. Like, he does, obviously, to people who aren't massive fans of the subgenre, he feels massively out of place, because...
Yeah, it's like that's Nancy's dad, what's he doing in this role? But it's like, he's a Giallo legend.
Yeah.
He was in the very first considered Giallo, and so... to have him there was like having royalty in it.
Yeah.
But it's like you really kind of have to know your history. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously, you know, he's in Black Christmas. He was in Nightmare on Elm Street. He was in a bunch of shit in horror. But like, this is returning to his roots. And this is 2 years before Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
So, you know, this made sense for him to be in it. But again, yeah, you kind of have to come from the background of this knowledge and know these things. So that's the thing, listeners, you know now.
Yes,
he's a Giallo legend.
We are nothing but if not an educational podcast as well. We might make a lot of sex and fart jokes and toilet humor, but we can sometimes teach people a thing or two as well, you know, whether that's about horror or whether that's about life. You know, we've got some stories to share, so
we do.
Having said that, I'll leave the floor open for you, Candy, if there's anything else about this movie that you would like to discuss or bring up before we move on.
Again, I gotta hand it to what I call Almost Goblin, and I believe on the last drive-in, that's what Joe Bob called it, the Tenebrae soundtrack, because it's not quite Goblin as a band, because Argento wasn't in it. Because Argento, you know, that was his band, Goblin. And they've had many members over the years. They still tour. I believe Claudio Simonetti, who did this, who was the main responsibility behind this soundtrack, is touring for Demoni, or Demons, which is a Lamberto Bava film, which is Mario Bava's son. But Lamberto Bava was a cinematographer for Argento. So, of course, he got the benefit of some really cool music. So I love the music in this. Also, Anthony Franciosa, he was a phenomenal actor, but he had trouble getting work in the States because he has a terrible temper, and he's an ass to work with, I heard. A real fucking asshole.
Yes, I was reading up on that as well. Yeah, I heard there was a very... very contentious relationship between Dario Argento and him. So, yeah, that must not have been particularly fun. Although, having said that, the alternatives...
But he's so great in it. You know, so it's like, if you want the performance, you got to put up with that shit, I guess. But he didn't end up getting tons and tons of work. But once he did a couple of movies in the States, which did really well, he ended up having to work mainly in, like, Italian films because... you know, nobody else would work with him.
Yeah.
He was a complete dick.
Well, we've heard some pretty... I mean, we've been watching and, you know, doing background stuff on movies for a long time. We know some horror stories out there about some actors. And
oh, yeah.
You know, I think at least you're upfront about being a dick. You know, so there's so many out there, I think, who portray this sort of open sort of friendly vibe, but then, you know, when it comes to, you know, cons and people approaching them and, you know, podcasters trying to speak to people, and then they're just real fucking dicks.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, Daria Nicolodi was in a couple of Argento films. She was in Phenomena later on. That was right before they got divorced. And they had a couple kids, one being Asia Argento. Less said about her, the better, I guess. And I used to like her. Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But, you know, having to direct your wife. But, and then for the longest time, and this is speaking again on Suspiria, he didn't give Daria the credit because she came up with a story for Suspiria. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the fact that their marriage lasted as long as it did, which wasn't super long, but long enough to have kids and do some movies together. Like, he finally later on gave her credit for writing the story. But originally, like, he did not.
Yeah. It's also interesting, obviously, like you say, he's directing his wife, and she's probably the one female character in this movie who gets like the least sexualized.
Yes. She doesn't get naked. She doesn't. And she's always dressed rather conservatively.
Aside from that scene where, you know, obviously she kisses Peter, that's really about it.
Yeah, that's and all they do is kiss. So, you know, but when you see like Phenomena, what he did to her and that, like, she was definitely like, she was the villain in that. So I'll just, you know, spoiler alert, the movie's not that good though. So,
we'll probably cover it at some point.
We'll get there. It's not my favorite at all. I think once Daria, it's interesting though, that when once Daria left him, that his movies turned to shit.
They just
got so bad. So it shows you how much creativity she added to his process. He's not talented, but it's just.
Well, I think you see that with a lot of directors as well. They have that person, don't they? And I think, for me,
that muse.
That muse. And, you know, you think of people like Deborah Hill to John Carpenter, you know, and the influence that she had over, you know, his movies as well, you know, and there's probably countless other examples, but that's the one that springs to mind straight away. You know, that I think, and we see this as well with a lot of directors who have, you know, the same kind of actors in a lot of their movies all the time, you know, Mike Flanagan
always directs his wife, Kate Siegel.
You know. Again, going back to John Carpenter, you know, you had Kurt Russell in a number of his films, and, you know, and a number of other people as well. So, you know, this
Keith
sort of
David.
Thing, Keith David as well, who's incredible.
I love Keith David so much.
But yeah. Okay. Well, with that being said, I think it's time for us to move on. And we shall talk about some trivia.
I'm sure if we bashed your head in, all sorts of secrets would come tumbling out.
I don't have a lot of trivia. Number one, because I knew you would probably... you're just a fountain of knowledge for this movie. So I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to get all this right. Number two, I couldn't actually find any finances about this movie. I'm not sure if that's something that you're remotely sort of familiar with at all, but I couldn't find any in the very quick sort of...
You know, I just know that he spent several million with that crane.
Yeah.
So, I'm
not sure what sort of what.
I don't know overall. Like,
I mean, this movie got a really wide release in European cinemas. It's got a wide theatrical release in European cinemas, which I think was good for him at the time. Because I don't think his movie before this had done particularly well. I think was it Infernal? Inferno? Was it that before this? I can't remember.
I think Inferno. Or in either that or Inferno was right after.
Yeah, I can't remember the order that they came out. But yeah, I think whatever had come before this hadn't done particularly well in theaters.
Well, here in the States, when they released, it didn't get a wide release. Tenebrae did not. In the States, it was released here as Unsane, which is a stupid title. But it mostly played like drive-ins, grindhouse-type stuff, because grindhouses were still... in effect back then. It didn't do like well at all, because it was just kind of released as one of those, here's another Italian horror movie, I guess, if you want to watch it. And we cut most of the gore out, so it's a bad cut. I have that cut just because I'm a collector, but it's not great. The full version is much better.
Yeah.
So in America, it basically did nothing.
Yeah. It was Inferno that came before this. I just quickly looked that
up. I knew it was right before, right after.
Yeah. So Suspiria, Inferno, Tenebrae, and then Phenomena was the lineage of those movies. So yeah. But yeah, so this one did pretty well at the theaters, and considering some of the things that had come before him. So the 3-minute crane shot that we've talked about at length, that took 3 days to shoot. That three-minute shot. It says here 2.5 minutes, but I think I actually timed it. I think it is closer to 3 minutes.
Yeah, because it plays the entire song, so it's long enough to play the entire Tenebrae theme.
And you also obviously mentioned about, you know, this hitting theaters and a lot of the stuff being cut. Apparently American distributors wanted this shot to be cut from the film as well for the American
and
release.
Argento said absolutely not.
Yeah.
So he stuck to his guns.
The rest of the trivia that I have, we've pretty much covered throughout the rest of this episode, but I'll quickly
know a lot about this movie.
I'll quickly run through it again. This movie is inspired after director Dario Argento was stalked by a fan. It's funny because that's 2 weeks in a row we've done authors being stalked by or murdered by fans. We did Misery last week.
Yes,
2 weeks ago. So maybe a wee theme going on here. Argento said that Anthony Franciosa is one of the most difficult actors that he's ever worked with, which we could. Quentin Tarantino is called the murderer Jane via the axe, his favourite on-screen death of all time for its intense imagery, including the key moment where she paints the wall with blood, which we've gone over. The only other piece of trivia that I've got down is that Christopher Walken was originally considered for the lead role in this film. And
I can't see it.
That'd be interesting, though.
It would be interesting, but I can't see it. Even though at the time, because, I mean, he's mostly known for comedy these days.
Yeah.
Like a lot of, you know, like more like Robert De Niro is as well, and Al Pacino. But like back then, Christopher Walken was a pretty serious actor.
Yeah.
He did like The Dead Zone and, you know, shit like that. So I think at that point in his career, yeah, but like I just can't imagine him giving the performance that Anthony Franciosa did.
No. So that's it. That's all I've got in terms of trivia. Like I can say, I kept it relatively brief anyway, because I thought we were probably going to go a bit longer during the main portion of the day. And I was right, we did. We went a little bit longer. So
yeah, sorry.
But if there's any other pieces of trivia, anything else that you have, you feel free to share. Speak now or forever hold your peace.
That's all. Like I don't know. I feel like I covered basically.
We've gone pretty in depth about this movie.
Yeah, we went pretty in depth. I knew that I would because I just love this movie so much, and there's so much to unpack. It's just a really fun thing to talk about.
Not normally our sort of main review section of an episode lasts about 45 minutes to maybe an hour at a push. We're currently sitting at an hour and a half. So
well it was just under, find out a lot of neat things,
just under an hour and a half, so we've definitely gone very in depth with this movie. With that being said, then we'll move on to our next segment, which is the ratings and the reviews.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
And as always, we will start off with the critic scores. IMDb is giving this a 7 out of 10. Metacritic has this at an 8.3 out of 10, which is pretty impressive from Metacritic. They tend to be ridiculously harsh in their scoring.
Yeah.
I find. So an 8.3 there. Candy, what do you think the Rotten Tomatoes critics scored this one?
Critics? It's so weird because I'm trying to think of like the subsect of people who are going to get this movie and who aren't. So even the critics. So I don't know. I'm going to say 75.
You're not far off. They scored at 81%.
Well, yay.
So
good,
that's a really high score from them. There's no critics consensus from this on Rotten Tomatoes at the moment. I think that's from 27 critics, I think I saw that from. So it's a smaller pool, but which is probably to be expected, though, for a movie like this.
Yeah, for this kind of movie.
What do you think the Rotten Tomatoes audience scored this?
I'm going to go higher. I'm going to go 87.
They actually went lower, but only marginally. Oh. Only marginally lower. So the critics were 81%. The audience was 78%. So they're pretty much in that same ballpark.
Pretty close, yeah.
So 78% fresh, which is both, again, I think higher scores than I was expecting them to give.
Me too. Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that I disagree with those scores, and we'll go over our scores very, very shortly. But I don't think I was expecting across the board there from the critics. In fact, the 7 out of 10 that IMDb has given it is the lowest out of all of those. So, you know, that's definitely a higher sort of average from them than I was expecting.
Yeah, IMDb can be a hotbed of just really strange reviews. Like, you know, where it starts out, they're talking about the movie, and then they go into like a religious rant or something. And like, you just don't know what you're going to get on IMDb.
Yeah. I've long considered doing a fun segment on the show about IMDb.
Yeah, because some of those are hilarious. So,
yeah, that might be something that we bring to the show in the future. I'm sure Nico would definitely find some of them amusing.
I could find some funny ones.
We always obviously throw it out to our viewers, listeners, and followers asking for your scores and opinions. Thank you very much to everyone who's given us your opinion, who has sent them in. We're only going to read out a couple this week, just like I say, because we're running a little over the time that we would normally hear. Ren wrote in, this isn't a review, but he did say, "Damn, Candy's been on the team for 2 weeks and already got you watching Tenebrae." I think that's where the, you know, false advertising.
Yeah,
comes
it was
from.
Like, he didn't even write a review. He just was like, "Yep, Candy's on the show because she's doing Tenebrae."
Our friend at the Movies for Days podcast, Jeff Newman, probably my favorite Argento, memorable kills, delicious camera work. I love that description. Popping music and an excellent cast. The mystery pulls you in, and the ending leaves your jaw on the floor. 9 out of 10 from Jeff.
I like that one.
I love that. And our friend Tim from the Horror Flicks and Guitar Picks podcast says Tenebrae is hands down my favorite film of Argento's that I have seen. The cast is one of the best he's ever assembled, and the way he falls into the dreamlike memories out of nowhere really add an unsettling feeling to a lot of giallo films lack. The score from Goblin is definitely up there as his best as well. The scene where the camera moves all the way around the house and up through the window is just mesmerizing. Got to go 9 out of 10 on this one as well. So, you know,
the people that commented really liked it.
Well, the one thing I really love there as well is, you know, obviously you mentioned it earlier, you know, probably Argento's most famous movie is Suspiria.
Yes.
And it's probably considered widely to be his best movie. I'm with everyone here. It's interesting that these are other podcasters, these are other people within our community. They're all saying the same thing. Actually, you know, Tenebrae is probably his best movie.
Because I've gotten in some kind of debates about why this is better than Suspiria, and a lot of people are like, "Oh, how dare you disrespect Suspiria?" I'm like, "I'm not really. I just think this is a better film." So it's weird because I've not heard this side of it.
Yeah. How dare you, by the way, have personal preference as well?
I know, right?
We obviously got some other scores and some reviews in as well, but I'm going to leave it there. On average, the listeners gave Tenebrae a score of 7.6 out of 10. So again, a nice, high, respectable score there as well. Obviously, next week when Nico's on the show, he'll give us his quick thoughts on it. He'll give us his score as well. Although I'll probably add his score in before next week just so I can give a proper up-to-date leaderboard. But that just leaves me and you for today, Candy. So on a scale of 0 to 10, what are you going to rate Tenebrae?
I'm sorry, but I have to give it a 10. This is one of my favorite films. It's up there in like my top 10 horror films of all time. One, this is a subgenre that I really, really love. And I think that this is the best of that subgenre. This is peak giallo. This is, you know, pure giallo. It's just the crime thriller. The twists are great. The cast is great. The music's great. Everything's great. It's got that artsiness that giallo films tend to have. It's done well and not overdone. And if it is overdone, then that's just right, though. You know, I don't know. It's just everything's just right in it. The characters are engaging. You either love them or you hate them, or you have strong feelings about them one way or another. You know, you feel sorry for Johnny. You know, you're annoyed with the girl with the dog. You both love and hate Peter, you know, Anne's a great person. Jane, you're confused about you. Like, you have feelings. It's not like there's no human fodder here. There's nobody that doesn't matter.
I think what's interesting there about that, what you say is, and it reminds us of when we did Army of the Dead, because it's the total opposite, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the complete opposite, because there's quite a large sort of core cast here of characters.
Yes.
You know, by the time you take everyone in, and there was a big one there as well, you care about none of them. You care about all of these, and care to the point where you have, like you say, a physical emotion about them. Say, I hate that character. Whereas with characters like in Army of the Dead, you're just like, meh, I really couldn't give a flying fuck what happens to them.
Yeah, like, I don't give a fuck at all, to the point where it doesn't matter what happens to them. I don't even hate them, because I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, basically.
Awesome. Okay, so a 10 out of 10 from Candy. Who'd have thought it? No, none of us. None of us saw that one coming.
Anybody who knows me knows I'm going to give this a 10. It's a movie I talk about all the time. And my brother bought me this really amazing collection. I've got the lobby cards. I've got several different posters from all over the world. Like, this is a film that I have collected every version of. So, well, yeah, it's a 10.
I hope I'm not going to disappoint you too much. I'm not going to give this movie a 10. That's probably no surprise to anyone.
I didn't think that you would. You never give 10s.
Number one, I never give 10s anyway. Part of what you said is a little bit of the opposite for me, because obviously you were saying this is, you know, one of your favorite subgenres, and for me, this is probably one of the subgenres of horror where I probably know the least, you know, and, you know, there's probably where most of my
We'll change that.
Yeah, but it's probably, you know, I've seen all the sort of key players in the subgenre, you know, but it's probably the one where I don't want to say like the least amount of interest, because that's not true, but I'm trying to say it's just the subgenre where I have the most black holes in my knowledge in terms of, you know, what I know about it. So it's not up there for me as my favorite subgenre. That's perfectly open to change, you know. The more I watch, the more I may very well fall in love with it. Having said that, I really love this movie. This is a great movie, and I think it's a perfect example of the subgenre. And like you were saying earlier, it's probably one of the best ones for people like me, who maybe haven't seen a lot of giallo or a lot of Argento or anything else, to get into it. It's probably the easiest viewing. It has obviously all the elements that you want, but it has that sort of crime thriller element to it as well, and I love a good puzzle and a good whodunit. You know, the effects are great, the score is great, the cast is great. It overindulges where it wants to, but it doesn't do it to the point where it's unnecessary, and I think it's just got everything right in it. But because it's obviously not my favorite, I'm not going to give it like a 9.8 or anything like that. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
That's solid, especially for it being, you know, like an introductory sort of thing, yeah. You know.
An 8 out of 10 for me. I think, like I say, all those factors. This is a great movie, and I think definitely one that anyone should watch, even if giallo isn't their thing, even if Italian horror's not their thing, or Argento, or any of the stuff that we've talked about today. Because, like I say, we've gone pretty in depth about this one. I think this definitely deserves to be up there. And with that, given our scores, the listeners and the critics scores, it gives Tenebrae an average score of 8.1 out of 10. And it means that it's currently in 16th place on the leaderboard.
Oh, wow. So I was like way off.
Yeah, so
I underestimated.
You massively. So it's got the exact same score, obviously. This is ranked on a point system, but also with an 8.1 is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, I saw that. I was
The Descent and Prey have all got 8.1s as well. It's just below Hereditary, The Lost Boys, Shining. You know, these are some of the biggest horror movies of all time, and Tenebrae is right up there with them. And again, I think as a testament to how we score our movies on this, because it does belong there. It totally belongs there, regardless of whether it's a niche thing or not. Not everyone has to like something for something to be the greatest, you know, there is, or in that sort of tier of really, really great horror movies. Not a lot of people are aware it's a niche horror movie, but that doesn't stop it from being one of the greatest, and I think it definitely deserves its place up there alongside.
And hopefully it will inspire others to seek out the film, because I think that they would really enjoy it.
Well, I certainly hope so. I certainly hope if there's any listeners out there who's listening to this episode who haven't checked out Ted and Bray. You know, hopefully you're not like me, because generally when I listen to other shows, I don't listen to ones about movies I haven't seen, just because I don't want spoilers. But if
right,
you are,
yeah, we spoiled a lot of things, but it still won't take away from the movie, because I've rewatched it a million times and it's still really good.
There's a lot of rewatch value in this film, which mm-hmm. you don't get in a lot of movies. You know, you get in quite a lot of horror movies. But for us as horror fans, it's not so much the story that we're always necessarily rewatching for, you know, because we're watching for the kills, we're watching for the effects, you know, we're watching for all these other sort of things, the scores and the characters and everything else. So, but there's a lot of rewatch value in this. So honestly, if anyone is listening to this episode, you haven't done so already, go check out Tenenbray. It's not particularly long. I think it's an hour and 40, it clocks in it. So it's not a big, difficult watch. You can watch the dubbed version. I watched the dubbed version earlier today, and it's a perfectly good version of the movie.
And as of this recording, it's still currently on
Shudder.
Shudder?
Yeah, that's where I watched
so,
it.
So not only can you watch just the version of it regularly, but Jawbob always has a lot of neat trivia. So the Last Drive-In one is still up as well, where he did Tenebrae, and it's got a lot of, he has so much information. So that's where I learned some of my stuff that I know about it was through Jawbob. So either one, I mean, you can find it streaming right now.
Yeah, so go check that out. If Shudder are listening, we'll accept our sponsorship payments in cash.
Yes.
But yes, so 16th place for Tenebrae, a really, really respectable showing. I hope Nico likes it as well. I hope he comes in and gives it a good score, because if he gives it a good score, that could bump up a few more places as well.
That'd be so awesome.
But it definitely deserves its place up there. Okay, what we're going to do quickly is we're going to go into a very brief new segment that's going to run for a little while. Obviously, as we've already said, Candy, you're relatively new to the show. This is your third full episode that you've done with us now. As a permanent co-host, obviously you did a number of guest spots earlier as well. But Candy's obviously got her hands on the leaderboard and is going to retrospectively give your score. So you could change this whole fucking thing. You could fuck this whole... We've spent... two and a bit years.
I don't know if I can save Halloween 3, but I'm going to try.
Yeah, we've spent 2.5 years curating this leaderboard, and we've been going on about like our top fives and our bottom fives and things that are where they should be and things that are, you could come along and fuck this shit clean up. But we're here for it. That's what we want. The power is in your hands. So I don't know how you want to do this, because obviously you're going to give us...
Do you want me to start from the bottom or the top?
I was going to ask if you wanted to do it that way, or if you want me to just like pick three at random, or you pick three
at
random.
Yeah, go ahead and do that because I have my scores all right here.
Okay. So obviously, like I say, yeah, Candy's going to kind of give us a brief retroactive scoring, so this could completely
change. Might hear papers rustling, guys.
That's okay. Since you brought it up then, and since you're so, so keen to try and save this movie, I want your score for Halloween 3 Season of the Witch.
For Halloween 3, I give it an 8.5.
Nice. Okay.
I think it's... What I like about it, and I'll be really quick, is that... One, there's no Michael Myers. It was doing what Carpenter had originally intended, which was to tell a different kind of Halloween story each year, and this was faithful to that. It was the one time it really strayed away from the formula, and I like it. One, Tom Atkins is in it, and I think that it's particularly mean to kill children, and, you know, we get some pretty fun performances in it, so I have to give an 8.5.
Okay. So that does change its place on the leaderboard. Halloween 3 Season of the Witch had an average score of a 4.3. It doesn't change a huge amount, obviously, because of the nature of the board, but it moves from a 4.3 to a 4.8. So you've boosted it up, and it's went from 93rd to 89th. So you've taken it away from that bottom five a little bit. It's at least now above Army of the Dead.
Yeah, because it did not deserve to be under Army of the Dead. Way better movie.
It is now, however, one place below Zombievers.
Oh my god.
But you could change that with that score when we get to it as well. Okay, now that I have the power to choose, I really don't know which ones, because I want to know all of them, but obviously we're going to stretch this out. Okay, let's go for your score for House of 1,000 Corpses.
Figure out where that's at.
So that's currently sitting in 55th place on the leaderboard.
Okay, House of a Thousand Corpses. I gave it a 3. I really famously hate that movie. I think Rob Zombie is better at music. What he does with music is what he tries to do with movies. And I like what he does with the music. Like, it, obviously, he's inspired by some of these grindhouse movies and these sort of, you know, lesser known horror movies. But then he tries to put all of that into a movie, and it doesn't work. Yeah. It's just, there's too much going on. I don't like it.
Listen, I love House of a Thousand Corpses. This is definitely going to be one of those ones where we're never going to agree on. I do think Devil's Rejects is a far superior movie to House of a Thousand Corpses. But I also totally get why people don't really fuck with I get why people don't fuck with Rob Zombie movies.
Well, I mean, Devil's Rejects has a little bit of originality in it, so.
House of the Thousand Corpses, as I said, was sitting in 55th place with a 6.8. It's now got an average of 6.4 and is down to 62nd. So you've actually dropped that 7 places today.
Ugh. Not far enough, but I'll take it. I just really famously hate that movie.
Okay, let's go for something a little higher up the leaderboard, because they were both movies that were in the sort of bottom half.
Okay.
Let's get your score for... Let's go for a top 10. Let's get your score for... I'm going to go for it. I'm going to go... We've done number 3. We might as well do number 1. Give me your score for Halloween.
For Halloween?
Yeah.
The first Halloween and Halloween 3 are the only two that I like. Halloween is such a low budget masterpiece.
Can I just interrupt? I'm actually nervous about what you're about to say here.
That's why I'm drawing it out a little bit. I actually think it's really well done. And so I gave it a 9 out of 10.
That's fine. That's absolutely fine. I was really nervous because obviously I know that, you know, Freddy and Jason, they're your guys, you know.
Yeah, Freddy,
Michael, and Jason, you know, they're the trifecta of horror. They're the top. They're on the Mount Rushmore. It's always the fourth one, isn't it, of Mount Rushmore of horror villains. Who's up there with Michael, Freddy, and Jason? But I know, and a lot of people in our sort of corner of the horror community are the same. Michael's like on the lower end of the three for a lot of people.
And Leatherface doesn't get mentioned hardly at all. And
no,
that's
it's usually
shame.
Ghostface, isn't it, that gets
fucking mentioned. Ghostface isn't... Don't get me started.
But yeah, so I'm really happy about that, because I quite often end up feeling like I'm defending, like in this sort of corner, I'm kind of the man with the one flag being like, the Michael guy, you know?
I'm a Freddy girl.
So I'll take that. It was sitting in fourth place with a 9.1. It's still sitting in fourth place with a 9.1, so... My fears are over. So thank you. There we go. That's the start.
I actually rated it higher than Halloween 3.
You did.
Because it's a really good movie.
That's it. For a lot of people, especially obviously the original. Listen, I've said it so many times before. I am fully aware that a lot of those Halloween sequels are straight up trash. Absolutely terrible. You know, Halloween 6 is one that springs to mind. Resurrection springs to mind. But then I've also spoken about multiple times that, you know, these fucking stupid sequels are some of my favorites because they're dumb as fuck. You know,
Halloween 4, for some reason, I used to rent all the time.
I don't even think Halloween 4 is that bad. I think it's fine.
It's not great. I was just really into it for whatever reason for a hot minute.
It gave us the birth of one of our, you know, favorite scream queens, Danielle Harris.
I don't know, but yeah, the original Halloween. Daniel Harris is Sean's chick. Like, he's really into her. She doesn't do it for me, I guess. I don't know.
Danielle Harris very much floats my boat, but that's probably a story for another day.
She's tiny. Like, I'm taller than her, and I'm 5'6". Like, she's tiny. I've met her at conventions. Halloween is just a classic.
No, that's great. So yeah, that's the first few movies of your re-rankings. We'll do another few next week. And then we'll keep going like that till eventually we get caught up. So it's going to take us a bit of time to get all the way there, but I think it's going to be fun to see how things sort of move around as time goes on. And obviously, yeah, we'll update everyone. The listeners will post some updates.
Yeah, listeners are going to be like, "What the fuck is she doing?
She's just changed everything."
Changing all the things.
But no, Tenebrae is up there, I think, taking it back.
I am so happy about that. I was really nervous about that.
I think as well, like, sort of comes from the fact as well, because when you were on the show to do Maniac, that was one where I don't think it got the love from everyone else that we thought it was going to get. Or yeah, it was just lower than we thought, because Maniac's currently sitting in 64th.
I know, and I was like, that's not right. Maniac's, you know, like, Maniac, if I count the original trifecta of Romero, it's my second favorite, because that's number one, is mm-hmm. Night, Dawn, Day. But second would be Maniac. It's one of my favorite films of all time. I'm just like, how can you not love this movie? It's so great.
Yeah. So it's nice to see on the other side of that, you know, a movie, which, you know what, I think there's a lot of similarities between these two movies as well, and between Maniac and Tenebrae. I think when you put them side to side, there is definitely a lot of similarities to them. So it's really interesting to see sort of how differently they're received when, you know, I think on the face of it, you know, they're really difficult. I would find it really difficult to pick between the two. You know, which one I consider to be a better film. I give Maniac an ever so slightly higher score, but not by much. So it's a difficult one for me. But that's the beauty of the leaderboard. That's the beauty of taking everyone else's opinions into account. Even though we may disagree, everyone deserves their opinions. Anyways, that is gonna do it for this week's show. Up next on the show, he's not here. It's Nico's pick, so he's not here to justify why he's chosen this. But up next on the show, we're talking all about Willy's Wonderland.
That's going to be interesting.
I'm kind of excited for this episode. I mean, I get excited for all of our episodes, but, you know, I think Nico picked it because we did Five Nights at Freddy's just before the new year, and I think for us...
Glad I didn't have to do that.
Yeah, so we'd covered Five Nights at Freddy's, and we just thought Willy's Wonderland would be better. So I'm very much looking forward to covering that next week. But thank you very much to Candy today for joining us. Don't forget, if you would like to support this podcast, we're on X at Damned Podcast. Facebook and Instagram is Pod of the Damned. You can email us at podofthedamned@gmail.com, and you can subscribe to us on Patreon, patreon.com/podofthedamned. As I said, thank you very much to Candy for joining us. Thank you to everyone for downloading and listening to this podcast at home. And don't forget, until next week on Pod of the Damned, just remember, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't.